Welcome to Unraveling the Anthropocene, Race, Environment, and Pandemic, a podcast series brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective, or LAC, at the Pennsylvania State University. As an interdisciplinary group, we promote visionary scholarship in the humanities, we build community across different fields of study, and we highlight the ways that different disciplines inform and shape one another. You can find more information about our previous events on our website, sites.psu.edu/liberal arts collective. In response to the COVID-19 pandemic this year, we have developed this podcast series as an intervention into our global ecological emergency. In our discussions with scholars, activists, artists, and community members, we address how global ecological crises both impact and are impacted by political turmoil, widespread outbreaks of infectious disease, and racial violence. Hi, and welcome back to Unraveling the Anthropocene. I'm Irene Agbedian, and in this episode, I'll be having a conversation with Dr. Mark Stevens. Dr. Stevens is a professor of family and community medicine and professor of humanities and master educator for the Penn State College of Medicine, University Park Regional Campus here in State College, Pennsylvania. He completed his undergraduate degree in liberal arts at the Pennsylvania State University and also holds a master's degree in kinesiology from Penn State. He received his medical degree from Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Stevens served for over 20 years as a family physician for the U.S. Navy, where he retired as chair of the Department of Family Medicine at the Uniformed Services University in Bethesda, Maryland. He holds a certificate of added qualifications in adolescent medicine. Dr. Stevens' professional interests include physician wellness, exercise medicine, and the use of art to promote professional identity formation in medical education. Mark, welcome to our podcast. I'm glad to have you on the series today.
Thanks, Irene. It's a delight to be here. Thank you for that kind introduction.
So I've actually given our listeners a brief overview of your long and extensive history, but could you talk a little bit more about your background and how exactly you came to Penn State?
Yeah, thank you. The bio says a little bit, but we're all connected by stories, so there's a little bit more to the narrative than that. So it's interesting. My father is actually a professor of humanities at Penn State. He's retired now, but he joined the Penn State faculty back in the late 60s at the branch campus. It's what's now called Brandywine. So my Penn State blood runs very, very deep for basically my entire life. So I came to Penn State initially, and I'm from a small town outside of Philadelphia, and I came here in my first semester was an utter disaster. It just didn't really go all that well socially, academically, and so I actually transferred out and went to Swarthmore College for a few years, where is really where I found my liberal arts calling. But Swarthmore is really expensive. And if your dad teaches for Penn State, it's a whole lot cheaper. So I came back here and finished my degree in liberal arts. And it was really during my senior year, wow, you got to have a job. You got to have a job. And that's when I found the sciences. And so I stayed under the tutelage of Dr. Carl Stadafalk and did a master's degree in exercise science. Now we would call it kinesiology. And it was during that period of time, again, we all sort of grow and iteratively evolve in who we are, that I discovered a love of medicine. And so, believe it or not, I knew where I wanted to go to med school, to Case Western. And so I had gone there prior to matriculation by several years, showed them my resume, and they literally laughed at me and said, you don't have a chance of getting into medical school. And I kind of knew it at the time. I didn't have the science background and my GPA wasn't stellar. So I said, well, that's fine. What do I need to do? And so they told me, and I did that and, you know, brushed up the sciences and brought up the GPA and, you know, continued to grow and evolve and went back to the same school 2 years later and literally said, you have no choice at this time but to admit me. So I was a little bit strong in knowing where I wanted to go and what I wanted to do. Interestingly, you know, just as I told you, Swarthmore is expensive. Case Western is expensive. Med school is expensive. There's no two ways about it. So in the late 80s, I actually joined the Navy. And it's an interesting dichotomy because I come from a Quaker town and was admittedly late in registering for the draft. It's just, you know, part of my fiber and ethos as a child is, I won't say pure pacifism, but it was... you know, respect and love that continues, that endures for humanity and for others. And so paying for medical school is how I wound up in the military. And I joined the Navy in the late 80s, and it was the most incredible experience of my life. And so my family and I, we were able to, for 27 years, see the world, experience different cultures, and had just an extraordinary experience delivering care to our active duty service members and their families, literally around the globe. And in that 27 years, I think we moved 9 times, something like that. And so moving gets a little bit old, and my wife, Patty, in the mid 2000, around 2015, she says, you know, I'm not sure I want to move again. And so then it became time to look at where to retire. And we met each other here, and we found we love this area. And it was just a real joy to return home, literally, to Penn State to take a position with the College of Medicine. And so that's probably more than what your listeners want to hear, but that's how I got here. And it's been an amazing journey.
That's fascinating. And like you said, we're learning about each other through stories. And I'd actually love to hear more about your work. I know that you were involved in the Wounded Warriors Project, so I was wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about your experiences there.
Thank you. I'd love to. I'll take you actually back to 2002, so post 9/11. At that time, we were actually stationed overseas, and it was a busy time. You know, we had troops coming and going quite a bit, and we saw a lot of injuries, and those stick with you. Yeah, those stories stick with you when you lose patients or you lose friends to the traumas of conflict. It's something that sticks with you. We eventually moved back to Washington, D.C. area, Walter Reed, National Military Medical Center. At the time, it was the National Naval Medical Center. And it was about 2010 now, where I was walking through part of the hospital that specializes in polytrauma. And what that means is folks who have severe injuries, multiple amputations, as well as traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress. So there's cognitive, emotional, and physical injuries of conflict. And as I was walking through the hospital, there's an art therapy studio in a wing of the hospital. And outside, the entrance was adorned with these haunting masks. And haunting's probably the right word. They were beautiful, but they were very stark. And so I knocked on the door and spoke to the art therapist, Melissa Walker's her name. We're collaborators to this day. And Melissa had found a secret to unpacking some of the stories. Many of our wounded warriors, these young men, don't want to talk, but through art, they were really able to show sense of loss in the context of identity. And so the National Geographic actually has picked up on this. So there's the Traumas of War series from the National Geographic shows some of these beautiful masks. Mm-hmm. But it was a real conduit to healing. And so I actually went back to my office at the medical school there in Bethesda, really, really impacted by that experience, and started talking to some medical students. And in some ways, sadly, higher education can be traumatic for individuals. They are forced in some ways to change their identity in ways that aren't positive for a sense of self. And so Melissa and I started pivoting our work a little bit to look at identity development in learners and what is that experience like. So that's really how it all started.
Wow, that's fascinating. Could you tell our listeners about your current mask-making project here on campus?
Thanks. So this has been super fun. You know, people hear that I'm a retired military guy, and when I say I love art and mask-making and identity, that is a little bit of a paradox for some folks. That may not resonate with an image that they may have of a retired military physician in their mind. We have several really wonderful projects going on. One is here at the regional campus of Penn State College of Medicine. So the main med school is down in Hershey. And about 4 years ago, we opened a branch campus, a full-time branch campus here, a regional campus. We have a 4-year curriculum. And we thought, wouldn't it be neat if every year we had our students create a mask that represents their sense of identity as a young physician in training? And so we're just about this spring, we'll graduate our first cohort of learners. And I'm really excited that we will then have a series of five masks that literally tells their story of their experience in a visual arts way of their experience as medical students. So that's one really exciting project. Another project that is very nascent, it's really formative right now, is thinking about how can we use the process of mask making as well as the mask itself to open up conversations about race, racism, systemic injustices in the context of identity, microaggressions, this sort of thing. And so that's really something I'm really excited about, working with Lynette Chappelle Williams, who is the new Vice President for Diversity and Inclusion at Penn State Health. We hope to implement this really system-wide to open up conversations for folks to explore hidden biases and how can we address those? How can we become upstanders? How can we deal with microaggressions and bias in the workplace? And so those are two of the bigger projects that we have going on. And then each year I try to get down to Hershey to have students participate. So literally in my basement, I have probably 300 or 400 masks that are just telling stories that we're yet to explore. So there's still a lot to be learned for sure.
Oh, wow. So you have this amazing project for your students, kind of chronicling their transformations in a very material and real way. And I personally find that fascinating. As a graduate student, you know, I'm very familiar with having regular forms of assessment, you know, your check-in letters at the end of the year, the beginning of the year meetings, those things that mark your progress. But then to see a transformation articulated in a new manner for me would be very powerful. It's something I would love to see. And this latter project I find very fascinating, this investigation of identity, self, looking at these social, political, other cultural factors that go into formation of identity, and again, putting them into a plastic medium and feeling, literally feeling what it means to be a person or to articulate an identity is fascinating. So I want to talk a little bit more about that. How did you get participants for the Unmasking Project, and what kinds of stories do they tell with the masks that you're able to recall?
Thank you. So all the medical student, and I've done some, I've done some projects with faculty on campus, new to Penn State, to explore their teaching identity. But everything we do is volunteer. And so it's tricky because the students, you know, you always, I feel you have to be very careful about this idea of coercion. You know, in other words, I would really want every student to jump in and participate and engage, but they may not want to. So curating a psychologically safe space for people to explore identity is really important. And so the all-volunteer aspect to this, I think, is important. You know, it's sort of an opt-in, opt-out idea. And so we will do the same with the Diversity Inclusion Project. In other words, mask making won't be the only smorgasbord offering that will be available to folks. They would be able to pursue other avenues to engage in dialogue about diversity and inclusion. So it really is designed to be an all-volunteer process. For me, what I've learned is one of the tricky parts to that is the people who opt in are often the people who may not be the best served. In other words, people who opt in often have a pretty good sense of self.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is. And people who are scared away by art, they look at this as, oh, this is an activity whereby I'm going to produce commercial art. In other words, I'm going to be judged, because isn't that what we do? We assess almost everything in higher education. And so really, really trying to dig in on this concept that art and mask making in particular is both process and product, that just takes a little bit of time, you know, for now we do this all the time. So it's sort of part of our culture, our educational culture. So the students don't feel as intimidated by it. But I appreciate, and it's true for me too, if the first time I ever did this, I sat down and you and I were sitting next to each other, I may look at your mask and say, holy cow, that's really beautiful. Mine stinks. But that's not the point. You know, the point really is a self-exploration. And so somehow I'm trying to figure out what's the best way to really continue to make that safe so that people who would be so well served by a much richer and deeper look at self, self-exploration would choose to opt in a little more often. The lessons really learned so far, I think, in some ways they're fascinating, but in some ways they're not surprising. And I think what I'm going to do is distill this down. And I'm trying to put this together in words and really a more formal paper, but what I'm loosely calling, and I won't own this phrase, the hero's journey of higher education. And so what the story of the masks now over these, we've been doing it about 6 years in different year groups of med students, so I'll stick to that lane. Really what these stories are telling us is what is six or seven predictable sequences. And let me tell you what they are, and you can tell me if you can relate. So the first is anticipation. In other words, I got the letter, I'm into medical school. This is so exciting. I can't wait. This is amazing. This is really what I've always wanted to do. I am so excited. So this really, this sense of excitement, elation, anticipation.
Okay. Yep. Check. Got that.
Check. And then school starts. And once that honeymoon phase, once that wears off, there's a little bit of uncertainty. Did I make the right decision? Am I in over my head? Am I the smartest? No, I don't think I am. I think everybody else here might be smarter than me.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
So uncertainty, yeah. And then it's the next phase is really one of sacrifice. In other words, all of us enter whatever it is in our calling with a sense of identity. And I'll stick to higher education. So we come into graduate school, to medical school, to nursing school, whatever it is, with, you know, varying degrees of formed identity. But we have to give stuff up. You know, I was a musician before going to med school. I haven't played an instrument in years. You know, there was stuff that I had to give up to be able to study to the degree that I felt that I needed to study to keep up, if that makes sense. So this sense of sacrifice, I am giving up elements of myself to achieve this. And then that creates I won't say this, Joanna Shapiro, she's a collaborator out at UC Irvine. She did a really nice paper on this sense of identity dissonance. You know, so I want to be this, but I am currently this, and there's a space in between. So this sense of authentic self versus projected self. In other words, I'm showing the world this, but I'm feeling something very, very different. There's an empty space in between, and that's identity dissonance. And we showed that in a nice paper, particularly in women medical students in the military. You know, they were trying to, there were so many different roles that they felt they needed to project and portray. They couldn't do all of it, and it led to this emptiness or identity dissonance. And in the story of the hero's journey, that's the abyss, you know. So whether it's Luke Skywalker, Mulan, or Harry Potter, whomever, that hero has the dark, you know, that real abyss. And then you sort of turn a corner and you're like, you know what, I can do this. I'm going to make it. I'm going to be okay. I have found my tribe, my guild, my people. I've figured out my study rhythm, and you begin to reclaim parts of lost self. You know, for me, part of that was basketball. I played a ton of basketball prior to going to med school. I gave basketball up to some degree, but I was like, no way, that is really important to me. I'm going to do that. I want that back. I am not going to let medical school take that away from me. I want that back. So you reclaim elements of self that become important to you, whether that's family or faith, or whatever it might be. And then what you do is you begin to integrate. So you're figuring this all out. So you're integrating all these, and we're all multiple and complex creatures of identity. So you're weaving this individual personal tapestry back together that had perhaps been stretched as you started your journey. And then at the end, you have figured out how you've organized it back into a complete sense of self in some new and fresh fashion that also includes this professional role. And then in medicine, what we do is we go off to further training, and the whole process starts all over again. And then I feel like that's our story of life. I will tell you, that's my military story. Is every 3 years when I moved, each place I went had its own hero's journey. In other words, man, I can't wait to get there. And like, oh, geez, I don't know if this is the right place for me and my family right now. And man, this work is hard, and oh God, this really sucks. And can I say sucks on a podcast? I don't know.
Oh yeah, definitely.
but then I'm going to get this back, and I like this group of people I'm working with, and this really is exciting, and I've got it figured out, and we got to move again. And so that's what we've really learned. That's the story of our masks in the context of a hero's journey.
Wow. So at the same time I see the mask as an exploration of this hero's journey, I can't help but think that there are ways of that making a mask is a way of getting yourself maybe from that place of the hero's despair, as you've categorized it, and into that phase of reclamation of self. Would you say that that's an experience you've had or that your participants have had?
And let me share a specific story of healing that I think gets at what you're asking. So the first group that I did this with was 2014. So it would have been about 2012 that they made the masks, 2013. So they were third year students. And I still have the mask on my wall. And so I wish our listeners could see it. So I'll describe it to you. It's half gold and half white. It has a veil. It has modeling clay representing a convoluted contour of a brain. It has a bright red cheek, and it has camouflage. And it's beautiful. It's just beautiful. I don't know what other word to describe it. And the woman who made this, and the other important thing to say is it's not the mask alone. We do have students write a narrative to go with it. You know, so there is more than just making the mask. There is more intentional reflection. The woman who made the mask, on her graduation, I asked her, I said, "Hey, I still have that beautiful mask that you made. Would you like it?" And she said, "I don't know what you're talking about," which floored me. I was like, "It's gorgeous. How could you not? I mean, it's beautiful. It's a wonderful piece of art. How can you not remember it?" And I said, "Don't you remember like a year ago?" "Oh, yeah. I don't feel that way anymore at all. The mask making was really helpful to get me through a dark time." So I feel like, to your point, there is a cathartic element. And having done this with learners all over the world, a relatively common experience for folks is they will say, you know, they created a mask to really help them unpack a difficult situation or a difficult period or a difficult relationship. And there was healing in that. So I do feel like the answer to your question, and that's one of the things we hope to do with this work, is identify how can we help people to avoid the abyss? You know, how can we just pull these conversations out into the open? How can we use art to really promote positive personal growth and healing in higher education?
That's beautiful. I want to talk more about this connection between medicine and the arts. So you're based in the College of Medicine at Penn State, and you're working on a project that's very much grounded in plastic arts. Can you speak about the intersection between arts and medicine? How does art, and in this case, mask making, lend itself to or amplify medical education?
And I'm so fortunate to be engaged with thinkers all around the country and literally around the world in the integration of humanities and arts in medical education. I think historically, right or wrong, for whatever reason, the basic and clinical sciences have dominated medical education for the last 120 years. And what we are doing now is just fully recognizing how important art and humanities is in medical education, really in what I would describe to you as four critical domains. The first of those domains is actually mastering specific skills. And so there's no question that the use of art or the incorporation of art into clinical or medical education improves observational skills. If you allow people to linger in art museums and put them through observational exercises, they become more astute clinicians. They look at things just a little bit closer. They're able to pick up smaller detail on physical examination. Similarly, an analogous curriculum allows people to listen better. And I don't know what your experience in medicine is, but I hear it all the time. I wish my doctor would just listen to me. And so the art of active listening is improved by engaging in arts and humanities. The second domain that I think is just so important is the use of art to improve perspective taking. you and I come from different places, from different worlds, from different backgrounds, from different experiences. How can I better understand your context to deliver the best care to you that I possibly can? And so engaging in arts-based curriculum helps us to better understand individual human perspectives. Rather than me just assuming that my perspective is the world view, how can I, with every person that walks through my door, be better at, again, listening, observing, and creating an opportunity to better understand that individual's perspective? Because if I don't do that, no matter what I recommend in terms of a plan or therapy, folks may or may not engage in that if they don't feel listened to or honored. But if I can try to come at it through the patient perspective, the opportunity for a therapeutic alliance is much higher. Another thing too is use of art for personal insight. And maybe this is the, you know, sort of the hero's journey we've been talking about. I think art is a wonderful way, whether it's a written art or a visual art or a tactile art, to get to know yourself better. Most, I would say 90% of medical students come from a background of basic science. They were biochem majors or biology majors. And when you put a piece of art in front of them or you ask them to create a piece of art, it is wildly disorienting and frankly scary. But if you can get past that, again, convince them that this is not a commercial art class, but a way to get to know themselves better, there's such value in that. And physicians who have a better understanding of self and who are better able to communicate from the perspective of the patient, the outcomes for that patient are just better. So that's really our goal with all of this, is to prove that folks who meaningfully engage in art and humanities in medical school and medical education give better care to patients who then become healthier. And then the final piece too, that we're in terms of art and medical education is social advocacy. How can you use art in the context of advocating for various social causes? And again, we're using the idea of mask making to explore systemic injustice, racial bias in medicine, and really looking forward to that project.
So for you, the arts facilitate communication. They help to establish connection. They're offering this knowledge of self and the opportunity to develop insight. And they overall improve care. That is incredible. And you did mention that arts are also a way for us to perhaps engage with these contemporary crises, to engage with systemic injustice and to remedy that. And so I want to lean into that question. What do you think an engagement with plastic arts offers during this contemporary crisis, or really these contemporary crises that are the focus of this podcast: racial violence, ecological disaster, and global pandemic?
So for this part of the conversation, I want to introduce two concepts and see if this makes sense. The first, I really like this concept. I don't own any of them, but they're helpful to me as I think about it. The first concept is the use of art to, the phrase that's used is, and I'm using air quotes now, is making strange. And what does that mean? So it's the use of art to look at a familiar entity through a different lens. Again, with the mask making, it's the use of the mask to look at yourself through a different lens and transmit that to the mask itself. And in so doing, you know, that's a process issue. And, you know, I personally feel that so many polar conversations can't find middle ground, or they very quickly retreat to the comfort of those various polarities. And when that happens, the opportunity for enriching dialogue or engagement is lost. So perhaps by this concept of making strange, perhaps if I use art to take a look at myself first through a different lens, maybe that's a bridge to conversation. Maybe that's a bridge to conversation. And following up on that is this concept of art as a third object. So if you and I are having a conversation, it's you and I. But if I am to introduce a piece of art into that conversation, you and I can talk to each other through that piece of art. And so I'll stick with the mask making. So if I create a mask that reflects my sense of identity and perhaps some of my experiences with racial injustice or bias, and then I present that to you, I can talk to the mask. And it's maybe a little safer to talk through or to that art object than it would be to talk to you directly. And then if you gift me your mask, it's the same process. So we actually have four objects if it's a bidirectional conversation and we've each made a mask. And allowing the mask to get the conversation started, I'll bet you, if we were to do this, you and I would have some really cool shared connections. I'll bet you we would have some life experiences that we could relate to. And then the mask can go to the side and you and I can engage in that commonality, in that common humanity. And maybe we can extend our conversation about race or bias or climate change, you know, whatever that might be. And then if the conversation gets a little uncomfortable, maybe we go back to the mask. And the mask again, oh, I forgot to tell you this piece. This is what I was representing with this element on the mask. So that's our hope. Is I would call it that principle of psychological safety is so important. If I feel safe with you in a conversation, I feel like we'll get somewhere. If I don't, I'm not sure that we're going to be able to reach any kind of a middle ground.
I think that's really important. And actually, I think that a lot of what you were saying about this, about using masks as kind of the interface to have these difficult conversations, reminds me of topics that have come up in my own work and in classes that I've taught on literature and what's called psychodrama, where actors in a play are given different masks, they're assigned a particular role, and through that, they're able to act out a particular trauma or explore deep feelings and unpleasantness and work together with the actors on stage to resolve the drama and the trauma. You're talking about masks, and we're talking about making masks, the element of the mask, and you've described that beautiful mask. So I want to ask you if you'd be able to describe the technical process of making a mask. What are we doing? What are we able to use? What do these masks consist of?
Oh, this is the fun part. This is where it's so much fun. You can honestly use anything you like. My personal preferences are two types of masks. There's a pulp mask, which is made from paper pulp, and then there's a paper mache mask. I prefer paper mache. It's a little more durable. It tends to hold the paints a little bit better, and it's just crisper in terms of an aesthetic presentation. But when I do big sessions, pulp it is, because it's much more economical to use pulp than it is to use the paper mache mask. So some element of a mask, and I do like to use three-dimensional masks, because earlier we talked a little bit about this concept of a projected self and a true self. So each mask that we use for the mask making has an outside and an inside. And as I frame the exercise, I do encourage all participants to paint both sides of the mask. What do you show the world versus what do you hold inside? 90% of participants focus on the external part of the mask. So that's just interesting. That's data. It's an observation in and of itself. So what I will do is I actually have a toolbox that I will take to anybody who wants to do this workshop, and it's super fun. So I really enjoy, I've done it with Penn State veterans, Penn State undergrads, teachers. It's really fun. Happy to come over and do it for your group anytime you want. But I would roll in with, you know, two dozen masks, and the blank mask sits on the table. And then up front, I would put out acrylic paints, water-based paints, various other craft items that you know, pipe cleaners or cotton balls or tiles, this, anything you would like to decorate the mask. Modeling clay works really well if you want a three-dimensional contour. So the supplies are laid out for you. And then I'll introduce myself. I'll introduce the purpose, and that's generally an exploration of self. Who are you? Contextual to medical student, contextual to teaching or graduate student. And then I would like to spend the next hour with you, and I always paint a mask with the group, as we together explore our sense of self, our sense of identity, who we show the world and what we prefer to hold to ourself. And then what almost invariably happens is about 5 minutes of nothing. In other words, people will sit around, look at the mask. The most common question next is, what am I supposed to put on here? To which I say, I don't know. You're you, I'm me, you do you, whatever you want. And then, you know, there's usually one or two tentative folks who might go up to the front and begin to, you know, spritz a little paint. I use paper plates as palettes, right? So they might put a dollop or two of paint. They might grab a brush. They might say, oh, that craft item looks pretty interesting to me. And then they begin to explore. And I always have music on in the background as well. And so what usually will happen is that 10 minutes of awkwardness. And then the amazing thing is, usually about 30 minutes of just really intense work, which is so beautiful to watch. You know, people are like, I can do this. And this is how I'm going to express. And where people start and end up are most often not the same place. They have a vision of what it is they want to show. And as they're unfolding that vision, it morphs or it changes somehow. And then after about 40 minutes, you can feel they're sort of begin to wind down. And then people begin to peek over like, oh, what did my neighbor draw? And then they might add a little bit. So then things begin to draw down and there's sort of a sense of peace or a sense of calm. And then there's a period where folks will reflect and look at the mask and maybe modify it a little bit. And then what we always will do in that session, I usually use an hour, is and about eight people per table is about right, maybe six to eight. So it should be small group, I feel. If you're comfortable, would you honor me with the story of your mask? And then usually what happens is there's a brave volunteer who tells their story and then, wow, that was an amazing story. And then eight stories unfold and it's time to go. And it's really an amazing, and then the last thing I'll say is I always offer for who participants, artists to take their mask with them. And it's about 50-50. You know, there are still colleagues from around the country who, when we talk, they're like, hey, man, I still have that mask hanging in my office. Equally so, there are many folks who say, you know what, I'm going to leave this behind. This was helpful for me today. This helped me in that bridging capacity to really look at something I needed to look at. But I'd prefer to leave this here with you.
Thank you for sharing that. So now I'm going to pivot our conversation a little bit more towards the political, because we can't talk about mask making and not speak about masking now as a public health and safety measure. I just want to ask you frankly, why do you think masking became such a highly divisive issue here in the States? And has any of that controversy impacted your work?
Thank you for asking that. So sort of. There are two other projects we have going on right now. One is asking medical students to take a selfie of themselves wearing their surgical mask or whatever they're using to protect themselves in a public health context in their lived environment. It was actually collaborating with one of the senior medical students down at Hershey. So we have not a ton of students chose to participate, but enough did that I think it's kind of fun. Folks just click in a selfie, and then we've trained some Penn State undergrads to you can read human emotion pretty easily through the eyes. And so we have some undergrads that are going to look at that and say what emotion that selfie is evoking. So that's kind of cool. The second part of that project is actually we gave them a blank template of a surgical mask outside and inside. Give us 10 words that you're showing the world, 10 words that you're keeping to yourself in an emotional context. And what we're finding is the students, again, are projecting this confidence, projecting this self-assurance to the outside of the mask. And on the inside, they're terrified. You know, they're anxious, they're afraid. And then they've written some really eloquent narratives about their own COVID experience. So that's one of the projects we have going on right now. A second project that I'm just so excited about, it wraps up this week, is we've asked Penn State student athletes to describe their experience of changes in identity as a result of the pandemic, and also ask them to do the same with a masked selfie. The response rate from the student athletes is much, much higher than the medical students, which I find fascinating. So I'm really excited to dive into that data. I don't know why it's become so divisive. The data's crystal clear. The best thing I can do to honor you is wear a mask. the best thing you can do to honor me is to wear a mask. So the act of wearing a mask is pretty straightforward. It's pretty, pretty simple in my eyes. But the politicization of it, and I'll speak from my own opinion and my own perspective, that it is mostly men who, and this is data, is men are less likely to want to wear a mask. And I do personally feel like it boils down to a threat to identity is what's happening when folks are resistant to the context of wearing a mask.
Can you say a little more about that? How is this perceived as a threat to identity? What is being lost or could potentially be lost for people who lean towards that type of thinking?
Yeah, I think it's just such a fascinating question. Like, why would covering part of your face lead to a sense of loss? And I don't know that it's a sense of lost identity. I think it's an alteration of identity. And for me, when I look at various social developmental theories as an example, I feel like that there's probably an answer that lies into your question that lies in there somewhere. In other words, how somehow altering how I am presented to the world from an external force creates dissonance in my sense of self. In other words, when somebody is mandating or telling me to wear the mask, that's not something I elected to do. That's a threat to me, and it creates dissonance to me, and my reaction to that dissonance then becomes non-compliance. That would be one way that I would think you could answer the question.
Thank you for thinking through that with me. Ultimately, though, to reiterate what you said and what numerous health and safety organizations like the CDC continue to say, the best thing we can do to keep each other safe right now is to wear our masks and to wear them properly. I'm going to pivot us back to your project. If you had to give some final words on what you hope to do with this project, what would they be?
Yeah, thank you for that question. I think we're all an evolving story. Every single one of us is an evolving story, and an incomplete story and an imperfect story. And so we opened with the beauty of shared narrative that from the beginning of human history, that's what we do, is we tell stories to make sense of the world, to make meaning in the world. And so what I hope to do with this work is several things. Is number one, to curate stories in the context of medical education. What is it like to be engaged in the process of learning to think, act, and feel like a physician? Where are the stress points? Where are the joys? And how can we use curation of those stories to help smooth the journey when we can? I think it's important. We all need to struggle. We grow from our struggles. You know, I wouldn't be where I am right now if I didn't have the struggles that I had. And while I may not be proud of those struggles per se, they define part of who I am, you know? So I think in medicine, we tend to describe cognitive errors and non-cognitive errors. So cognitive is things that I should have known, but didn't. Non-cognitive is ways I should have behaved, perhaps, and didn't. And so I really think that for me in particular, the use of art and mask making specifically, I think it's going to help us understand potential non-cognitive or behavioral stress points as an early warning system, if I could say it that way, that we might be able to identify students who are likely to struggle with professionalism. And if we can use art to intervene, not only to identify, but to mitigate, then I think that's a win.
Thank you so much for that. Where can people interested in your projects, either to see the work being done or to participate, go for more information?
So we actually have, Penn State has a website that's very nascent, very, very early stages. So I think it's masks.psu.edu, I think, is the URL. I'm not entirely sure, but a Google search of mask making Penn State gives a little bit of the history, and it's there's some samples of through the last year or so of some of the masks that folks have made. I'm personally always very interested in collaborating with folks. I am at a stage of my career of really wanting to give things away. So for me, collaborating with folks who might be interested in this, for me, is a tremendous gift to make those professional collaborations. But if others can take this idea and run with it, I'm a simple country doctor. I am not a quantitative or qualitative research expert. So I'm always looking for help and for others who would like to share the journey. This has been a very delightful conversation. The sort of the organic twists and turns have been really delicious for me. I've enjoyed that very, very much. As I reflect on things that I might hope to have transmitted to the audience, I think everything that I need to say or wanted to say has been said.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule and giving such detailed and rich answers. This has been a wonderful conversation for me, and I'm excited to see how your projects develop. This is brilliant. Thank you for coming on to the podcast.
You're welcome, and thank you for the invitation.
To our listeners, this has been Unraveling the Anthropocene, and we'll see you again next time. Unraveling the Anthropocene is brought to you by the Liberal Arts Collective at Penn State. This episode was produced by Irene Agbidion. Be sure to subscribe and follow along wherever you get your podcasts.